Hello, and welcome to the Marketing Times Analytics Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Sofranis, and today I'm on with Hal Smith. Hal, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yep, Hal Smith. I'm the founder of H Street Digital, which is a performance advertising agency, and happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Alex.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I'm so glad to be on with you, and I love the agency model. I want to learn about how your business works. Can you give us a little intro to the services you provide?
Yep. As a performance advertising agency, what we do is we really try to figure out what our clients' customer acquisition cost is. And we work with a lot of direct-to-consumer type companies, so they're all B2C. So once we identify what that customer acquisition cost is, we work across all the major digital advertising platforms like Meta, TikTok, Google Ads. And essentially what we're trying to do is scale as much as possible in terms of spend while maintaining that target customer acquisition cost. And a lot of what goes into that is optimizing the creative inputs that go into these platforms, managing these campaigns for scale. And then once that traffic hits the website of our client's website, we're really focused on conversion rate optimization just to make sure we're trying to reduce as much friction as possible, increase conversion rates, and increase average order value.
So let me ask a pretty basic question, but maybe it's not basic when you actually start to implement it, but how do you calculate customer acquisition cost, what the ultimate value of a customer should be?
Yeah, this is a lot of work with our prospective clients. The first thing we try to figure out is what is their contribution margin. And so the most simple way of saying this is all in cost to actually produce and ship that product. What does that look like? And then how much profit are they making on top of that? After that, we want to figure out the profit margin they want to make plus our fees plus advertising costs, right? And then that is effectively what their customer acquisition cost should be. Another way of looking at that too is based on more of a recurring or subscription model, which is more looking at the lifetime value of the customer, right? And then we'll also factor that in for clients that are more heavily focused on recurring customers.
Do you use any particular tools to measure customer value, or is this very manually calculated?
Yeah, you can use tools. Like, there's plenty of analytics platforms out there. We don't use any specific tool. It's more manually calculated. And so what that means is we effectively, for the most part, we'll go into a Shopify, we'll export all the customers, we'll identify unique customers, typically by a unique identifier like email address, and then we'll see when they made their first purchase and then the subsequent ones, right? And we'll see the time frame in which those purchases were made. And then we'll use that to develop that lifetime value calculation.
So I want to ask about how you break through the noise, because it seems like there are so many different agencies. How did you find your differentiating point?
This is a great question, because I think it's something that you constantly work on. There are three main elements, I think, to what we do as an agency that is different. The first one being is the team's experience. So I've intentionally gone out and recruited and hired people that have a massive amount of experience in the direct-to-consumer space. And what does this mean in terms of numbers? The collective media spend managed by our team members is over $500 million, right? You know, we've launched over, you know, tens of thousands of campaigns for direct response advertising. And then we've generated what it's easily billions of dollars in revenue from managing that scale of campaigns. And so the team that we have, they've just worked at a level that most people haven't, right? And I think the important thing with that for us specifically on the performance side is the scaling process. So most people have not experienced taking an account from spending about $10,000 a month to over $1 million a month, right? Our team members have done that, right? So just knowing what that looks like and knowing that process and experiencing that is so valuable, right? I think the second thing is we're heavily, I would say, like, metric focused and analytics focused. So we have very enhanced reporting platforms that we look at to optimize our campaigns. And we have a very kind of lengthy naming convention and UTM development process, so we can test lots and lots of different variables and look at it in almost real time in terms of performance. And I think within that too is a lot of our decision making around optimizing campaigns is very focused on what we say is like an expected value calculation, right? And so what that is, it's not really throw it against a wall and see what sticks, but instead we have a percentage likelihood of success And then we have a number that's assigned that we think the impact will be. So for example, we're running two creative tests. We have one that is an iteration of a known well-performing ad. And then we have something that's a net new big swing ad. It's a totally new concept for the account. We'll assign a likelihood of success for the iteration versus the net new ad. And then also what we think that will make in terms of impact on return of ad spend, right? And so that allows us much better decision-making and much more accurate optimizations. And so I think that allows us to scale much faster. And then I think the final piece really is our ability to move really quickly, our high velocity like of testing, and then our communication cadence with the client. So most agencies will have a monthly cadence and they have a few objectives they try to get done during that month. We're doing about 3 to 5 optimizations per platform every single week, and we're quantifying our expectations around it. Then we're going back and seeing how we've done, and we're making sure we're always tracking that.
So I want to talk about something that I'm personally trying to figure out a more optimal way to do, which is how do you measure the effectiveness and the return on ad spend for lower funnel marketing? And
yeah.
The reason and let me give you a little bit more context to this. If you had to, there's different ways to measure, like in terms of how many people you're convincing to purchase that wouldn't have purchased otherwise. That's what it's going to give you a success measurement for. Or you could look at how many people you are literally getting to purchase, how many people are clicking your link. And maybe and you can even measure the incrementality around that. Are you actually causing people to purchase that otherwise wouldn't? Or are you really just attaching to inevitable customer journeys? However, there's benefits to that too. If you route people to a call center, they can close those individuals at a higher rate, and there can be a lift from that perspective. So what is the approach that you take to optimize or to measuring the return on lower funnel ad spend?
Yeah, it's a great question. That's, I think, the $1 trillion question in advertising today is really around attribution, and then lower funnel specifically. I actually think it's significantly easier to track lower funnel than upper funnel, right? There are a couple ways we do this, and nothing is 100% accurate, right? So we have to first just recognize the reality that we're never going to be 100% on this. But I think if we can have some fairly high degree of accuracy, let's say like 70%, we're pretty comfortable with that. But where do we start? We start with last click UTM based reporting, right? So we go into the source of truth, which typically is a Shopify account. We have our UTMs that are assigned to specific ads and campaigns, and then we pull the revenue out that's associated with that, right? Typically, what we're able to do is parse out what campaigns, because of our UTMs, that's attributed to. So to your first point, selection effect, right? These people might have made that purchase anyway without seeing our ad, right? How do we hedge for that? I think the important thing is how you do things around exclusions for social ad campaigns, right? So you're excluding existing customers, or you're excluding people that might have viewed a page before. You're at least assuming in some degree that it's net new people who have not previously seen an ad, right? And you can even do exclusions based on a view, right? Then you can do that on like the search side too, where you're not bidding on brand keywords. You're bidding on, I would say, tangential keywords, right? High intent tangential keywords. So if you're selling sunglasses, you're not going to bid on Ray-Bans, but you're instead going to bid on best value sunglasses, right? And so that could be just someone that's shopping around and they're not necessarily looking for your brand specifically. I think the other thing too is what we try to do is instill like a third-party app for attribution. And so what's common in the direct-to-consumer space are two platforms. One is Triple Whale, another one's Northbeam. But they do have some modeled attribution where they can show you that this is like net new, you know, prospecting. It's new customers, people who have not previously been associated with your brand, and you can attribute that to lower funnel. And I think the third thing is being smarter about your pixels on ad platforms, so like what you're seeing on Meta or Google Ads, and trying to hedge for that as much as possible in terms of pixel attribution. So what we do is a one-day view, one-day click model. And so the idea is they saw that ad within one day, or they clicked on the ad within one day, and that's how we have an attribution, right? So we try to zoom all the way down to the most, I would say, like narrow lens you can. And so what we do what's effective by doing that is we're not reporting necessarily all the revenue that's being driven from our campaigns. We're only reporting on a percentage of it, but it's the safest way to measure that the impact of your, you know, lower funnel ads are actually driving that revenue, and you can extrapolate a little bit of like larger revenues being driven by it, but it's just not in that very narrow window and way of looking at it. But the kind of selection effect side of things is really interesting and hard to manage on the lower funnel side of things. I don't think anyone has really figured it out that well, but I will say in cases where we really want to hedge for that, what we've done is, I can't remember the name of the actual like technical name for this, but you mentioned, you spoke on this a little bit, but we'll exclude a number of states. So what we'll do is if we want to do
testing this versus control.
Yeah, exactly. And so we'll take a list of states and we'll just split them up based on like their overall like performance. And then we'll just exclude one set. And then we'll run ads in the other and just see how it does. And we've always seen a lift with that. So we know where ads are driving revenue, right? And you can do that within ad platforms as well. Meta offers this as a solution that you can actually sign on for. And I think there's limits with doing that because you do have to be spending at a relatively high volume, but they do offer that as a product.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I totally agree. I think that the missing piece, and this really is, I think, an industry-wide challenge, is understanding the lift of driving traffic to a direct sales site versus letting the customer close on their own, and then factoring that into the calculation for incremental impact.
Yep.
So even if you're not driving a lot of sales to be done that weren't done otherwise, you're driving a lift in value of the sales. And that should also be a big factor in how the tactics are quantified in terms of success.
Yeah, I think one thing I actually missed that is helpful for us too is we do post-purchase surveys, right? And then you get to ask them like, what was the reason why you made this purchase today? And then list the items. And that's been helpful too. But it's always hard to differentiate. Did you see a direct response ad, a lower funnel ad, or did you see an awareness ad? But I will say too, for a lot of our clients, they don't actually do a whole lot of awareness campaigns. So it really is just the lower funnel campaign types that we're running for.
Yeah, out of curiosity, at what stage of a business would you recommend bringing in awareness ads? Because obviously it's going to be very awkward for a business owner that's strapped for cash to convince them, hey, spend a bunch of money. It's not going to come back right away, but it's going to increase the number of people who know you, and eventually it will have an impact. How do you go about convincing them for that?
So the easy answer I can tell you is there's a reason why we're on the lower funnel performance side. It's because I can't justify that myself. Yeah. But there's a couple of things. So one is based on how much education there is in the market or where they are in terms of like product market fit. There it is, I believe it's really important to run some form of brand campaign, some form of awareness campaigns if there's not a whole lot of education about the product or the service that you're selling. And you're gonna have to do some work to convince potential customers like what you're doing is important and is gonna solve a problem for them. I think what I've seen at least with brands is they typically start spending more aggressively on the brand side of things if they're well into eight figures in terms of revenue. I think the other thing which is important with brand advertising, if it's a competitive market and you really need to make sure that you have good share of voice in your target addressable market. And then I think another thing which is important too for brand advertising is if you're also like you're breaking into a new market or you're creating a new category and you want to take up as much market space as possible before a competitor hops in. And I think it would size a brand, but it's also too, I think context is really important in what you're dealing with in terms of the business opportunity.
Yeah, that makes sense. It is a way to buy yourself into the conversation, but an expensive one at that.
Yeah. I think actually, if I could add on another one is if you've already saturated what could be like early adopters or your kind of core customers, and you want to get more people, quote unquote, into the funnel, and then you need to branch out further and do better like brand advertising to just reach a larger group of people. And I will say that's actually pretty important with social advertising because these social platforms, especially how they're so heavily machine learning driven, it identifies this core group of people that it thinks are best to convert. And it's sometimes hard to bump it out of that group and to get it to expand further. And then sometimes you really have to do that with more of a brand campaign. But I would say it's based on your addressable market size and it's based on how effectively these platforms are scaling. Like we've taken a client from spending about $20,000 a month to $1.5 million a month. And we did that without having to do any type of brand advertising. It was just their addressable market was so big And the kind of offer and message of the ad was so clear that we didn't really need to do too much education. So there are some cases where you can just keep scaling spend and it's totally fine. But I do think there are other situations where you have to just educate a larger group of people in order to get them into the lower funnel.
Yeah. And what would you say that it also goes along the lines of B2B versus B2C in the sense that a B2B company would want more awareness advertising and more salespeople driving the lower funnel versus B2C, you can maybe use more marketing tactics or ad tactics to close those sales?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's great you brought that up because I'm so heavily, I got my blinders on in the B2C space, so I'm not even thinking outside in B2B. But that's also part of the reason why we don't work with B2B companies, because I do think brand advertising is incredibly important, because that's the thing is you're trying to develop that brand equity with this group of people, and then you're going to engage with them somewhere else. You're not going to have them convert over a digital ad, right? But if you can build up that brand understanding, that brand knowledge, and then you have a salesperson reach out to that company, it's going to be a much more effective sale. B2C advertising, especially what we do on social, it's very impulsive, right? You see an ad on Instagram and you're going to make a purchase within a couple hours, right? It's very different from B2B where it's very large value. B2B, you're selling services or products that are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions. Like that's a much longer sales cycle, much harder like decision-making process. And so therefore, it's really important to build up that brand equity at the front end and close it with like real people, right?
Yeah, I'm also curious, when you're talking about lower funnel for B2C, what are the tactics that you think are best? Let's start with there, but I'm also curious, what do you think about the automated messengers, like the ChatGPT auto messenger, auto invite technologies that have been coming out recently for lower funnel?
Yeah, I guess maybe on the auto messaging side, maybe I'm not as aware of this, but what do you mean by that? So it's like you can engage with like a brand's like Facebook page and they have a chatbot they'll close them?
So they exist on multiple social networks. I've been using one on LinkedIn that I'll just search in the search bar marketing director and it'll pull up the list of people, and then it's a bot, it's a web bot that will go down each person and it will invite them and create a custom invite for them. And there's varying levels of customizability. Now that we have ChatGPT, some of the tools actually can interact and have a conversation with them just with ChatGPT with a little bit of direction ahead of time. Others, it's more static. Like the one I use for LinkedIn is pretty static, but you can put in their name and their role and so forth. They have varying degrees of effectiveness, but basically if you give it the direction of, hey, interact with everybody who liked this post or everybody who joined this page, whether it's LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter, all of them they work similarly, but their point is to find interested people and move them from, maybe it's more mid funnel than lower funnel. But this is something I've noticed recently is coming out, is these capabilities. I'm not sure how effective it is. It sounds like from what you're saying, this is not necessarily the silver bullet.
Yeah, so I guess I can't speak to it too much because we haven't done too much in that space. I will say that we have, in terms of, let's say more on the conversion rate optimization side of websites. Like we have clients that have these kind of chat messenger bots set up on the page. They also have stuff for abandoned carts. I think that I've seen it. It's very effective in terms of abandoned cart, like reducing abandoned cart rates, re-engaging customers. But I will say we haven't really have touched that much, so I can't really speak to it. It's interesting you bring that up because I do now want to look into some of these platforms and see what we can do there.
Yeah, I'm. Let's connect after this. I'll give you a couple of names, companies and people that have told me about it. Yeah, I think it's like a new thing that's coming out in the marketing space, because this is like one-to-one marketing is starting to creep up in the technology space. So there's one notable one on Facebook that I just learned about that basically, like I said, it's anybody who's in a group and anybody who's liked or interacted with a post. And it'll scrape all of those people and message them individually and try to close them like a salesperson would directly. And so there's all sorts of different groups on Facebook. You can break into even B2B groups of just those like CEOs and stuff that are part of those groups. So it's interesting for sure. And I think that it does help with that lower funnel concept of just trying to close people. But I guess that if just imagining, I know that you might not use this technology yet, but if you can just imagine how it works, would you want to use that for a lower funnel to close people, or would you want to use that for a more of an upper or mid funnel to start to get in the consideration for people?
Yeah, I guess I'll speak to the lower funnel side because that's where we spend most of our time. Yes, we would want to use it. I think what's really unique about that is that it's more targeted, right? Because based on where these people are in terms of where they're spending their time, let's say these Facebook groups, that they're more likely to engage or purchase something from a brand. And I think, too, it's more personal. And we know that anytime you increase personalization, it is more effective sales. And then I think the other thing is it's really scalable, right? I have worked with clients who have support teams, right? And that is not as scalable. If you have an automated bot that's using these large language models to engage with people, it's infinitely more scalable, right? And so I think for all those things, it's really interesting. I do think my gut tells me it is going to take work in terms of training this, whatever it is, like this, let's say bot, to know how to say the right things about these products and know how to say the right things to these customers. So I'm sure there's similar tactics that we use for like inputs and ad creative that we will basically be able to train these bots on in order to say the right things to customers to convert them. But I do believe this is the future of customer engagement going forward, because from my general sense is we're becoming increasingly consumers are becoming increasingly more fractionalized, and they have like increasingly more fractional like identities, right? And so the better brands can get at identifying these little groups and identifying how people are associating with their brand and kind of creating a community around that, the better they'll be. And if you can create these kind of scalable engagement bots, for the lack of a better word or phrase, I would see that becoming increasingly more effective. So let's say we have an outdoors brand, we have bots that kind of speak that language and can engage with the right people who are on the Facebook groups. Let's say it's a rock climbing group, right? That would create much more affinity to that brand if you can have that kind of voice that's in these scalable like messenger bots, right? And then they can say the right things to push someone down the funnel and actually have them purchase. It's like having these, it's like a salesperson instead of just leveraging like a social media ad, right?
Do you think that there's a limit to hyper-personalization where people start to see it a little bit more negatively, that they feel like it's too intrusive?
Oh, 100%. I guess that is the challenge to this. And that's been the challenge for hyper-personalization in terms of ads and how we track people and deliver the right content to them at the right times. I think there obviously has been a big blowback with that. That's part of the reason why the iOS 14 update happened that's why CCPA happened. But I will say too, it's interesting because my perspective and what I've heard from people is people actually do enjoy personalized advertising. They find it much more convenient and easier, but at the same time, they do have those kind of concerns about recognizing the fact that personalization has come from that more enhanced level of tracking. But I will say for people I know, people I've talked to, they enjoy being personalized. They enjoy things that are personalized. So I don't know what that means really in terms of how consumers would respond to a bot like this. But we'll have to see. It's always pretty interesting because people say one thing, but they actually enjoy it, if that makes sense.
That's an amazing point. I think you're right. I think people will like hyper-personalization more than they think they do. They will.
Yep. Yep.
Because at the end of the day, it's less wasted attention. What do you think about this, the death of the cookie? And do you think that the industry will find a suitable replacement? Or do you think this is really the end for that sort of technology?
So I think the industry has already found a replacement, which is like server-to-server integrations between analytics platforms, like social platforms, and then brand databases. And so what I mean by that, like in most simple terms, there's the conversions API that Facebook has with Shopify. And Shopify has all their user activity and customer data on their server. Meta has all the engagement activity from the, let's say, Instagram platform. And you can work around that and you just have that server to server integration, and then they can go match that data. And okay, we already do that. That was a workaround for iOS 14. I think increasingly people will try to figure out other things like that. I think cookies have always been relatively inaccurate. there's another thing too, which is like identity graph mapping, right? And there are data companies that are becoming much better at that. And that kind of sits within that, let's say, third-party data provider. They can do that in absence of cookies, and they have data sources that they're piping in and matching consumer behavior and data within their own warehouse. All it does is I think it actually creates better moats for data companies, and they can do a better job leveraging that internally and then selling it to advertisers, for example. But I just believe it's data will be more siloed and protected at the end of the day. That's effectively what's going to happen. But I do think the way that data is collected is still happening, right? iOS, for example, they had the iOS 14 update, which basically cut access for all these other platforms that are on iOS devices. But that doesn't mean that iOS has stopped tracking that data about its users. It's just now protected and owned more by Apple. So I think that's the future, and we'll see what happens. But it's made it harder for like cross-device tracking. It's made it harder for tracking consumer behavior across the internet. But it hasn't really changed intrinsically like what these platforms are actually tracking about you. I don't think it's really affected them too much.
That's really interesting.
The last piece of that too is I think it's forced these platforms to build better predictive models, right? And so with that too, it's like maybe they're not getting this direct one-to-one data transfer, but they're doing better jobs of having like ways of modeling behavior, right? And I think that's more of the emphasis today.
Yeah. Speaking of which, with your company, do you do direct mail prospecting?
No, we don't. It's actually interesting. It's a lot of people have switched back over to that, and it's actually really effective today because there's a time where everyone got tons of junk mail and then it all disappeared. And then I know a lot of direct-to-consumer brands have gone back to direct mail, and it's actually working really well for them just because there's a little bit of a vacuum right now.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And it's cool that aside from all of the digital privacy stuff that's going on, there's still this old industry that just keeps on kicking of maintaining a prospecting database of everybody that can be sold to. And it's interesting how it's just existing in parallel to this massive cyber universe that we're also operating in parallel.
Yeah. Yeah. And direct mail has always been very invasive in terms of the data they collect on people. And it's also too, because I just believe, I don't directly work in the space, but I've always believed just from hearing, talking to direct mail people, but there are generally less restrictions around collection and transfer of data. So I don't know, but it's just not as obvious. And you know, at the end of the day, someone gets a piece of mail, they throw it away and they forget about it. But I think when you're repeatedly reminded by digital ads of like how you're being tracked, it becomes a little bit more salient for you, right?
Mm-hmm. So back to the actual sites or social media sites that you find most effective for lower funnel, what is it, Instagram, or what would you say, or what's the determining factor for which social network to go with if you're trying to do lower funnel marketing?
Yeah, the biggest determining factor for the success of a platform or one of these social media platforms is for us just how effective we are at scaling spend around a target CAC, right? So that's the only thing for us. We will incrementally scale up spend when it starts working, but we find sometimes certain platforms do better than others for specific brands. Now, that being said, there's a pretty common distribution that everything falls into, and I would say generally it's about 40% on Meta, so Instagram and Facebook. I would say about 30% on Google Ads, and then about 10% on TikTok, and about 10% other things that might be working okay. So like Bing search, for example. Outside of that, it really depends on the customer cohorts you're going after and who the brand is. I can say definitively Facebook today skews older, right? Obviously, TikTok skews a little bit younger. Google Ads is pretty much effective across all age groups. Certain ads just do better in terms of presentation on video, right? And so they might actually do much better on TikTok. Other ads might do better on a Facebook newsfeed. So for us, we test a lot of things. We try to figure things out, but we just know generally most of that spend is going to happen on Meta and Google Ads. And I would say too, the other important thing to remember is just the amount of users on the platforms, right? So Google threw out all their ad products. And when I say Google, generally, it's Google Search, it's PMax, or Google's way of delivering ads across all their system. And then it's YouTube, right? It's the Google Display Network. That's like a lot of the internet, right? And then Facebook has, I think it's now like almost 3 billion users globally, right? And then the US, I think it's like over 200 million. Just such a massive amount of the population that is on that platform. So therefore, it's very scalable, right, for an ad campaign. The majority of people are on that, just in terms of like just numbers. A large part of your addressable market is also going to be on that ad platform, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas TikTok's a little bit smaller. And I will say one thing that's interesting that I constantly have talk about with clients is they believe that because TikTok is a younger platform, that therefore only younger people will be on it. But we've been successful running ad campaigns targeting people that are, let's say, 35 to 50, for example, right? And so that's not necessarily true. It's just really what your addressable market is and where they're most active, right?
That's a great point. And where do you learn about where your addressable market might use, which networks they might use, or what their habits are?
A lot of just research. So it comes in I'd say we do it in a lot of different ways. So one is, the first thing is just talking to our client, right? And we just ask them, who is your customer? Tell us in both qualitative and more quantitative description. And so quantitative can be like demographic things like annual income, right? We also can take like lists of existing customers and we'll upload them to different platforms. And then we can figure out from there like how they match against it. And then if we build lookalikes, like what that eventual lookalike audience size will be. So we'll have an idea of how big they are. We'll just do a lot of research based on the product. So let's say we're selling something that's for parents, right? It's maybe like a child care product, right? We have a client that does that. It's pretty clear to us based off of that. It's okay. So like, where are they most active? What demographics can we pull from that? And then I think the thing too is we don't try to make a whole lot of assumptions. We will make some initially. We just we'll run the campaigns and just see how they're doing. And then we'll just start scaling up spend and then and pull from that and really try to analyze it from there. But I think it's the most simple thing is they're just large populations on Google, on the Google ecosystem as well as Meta. So it's pretty clear that you're going to be able to scale up a campaign really well just because the majority of people are on those platforms, right?
Yeah.
I think actually just on that too, I think people always forget like sheer size of the users on these platforms. And so if you have we have an e-commerce brand and they're spending, let's say $50,000 a month on ads, let's say their customer acquisition cost is $100. I'm going to hopefully get the math right here, but effectively they're trying to sell 500 products a month, 5,000, let's say 500, right? That's 500 new customers a month, right? It's not that large, right? And so it doesn't really matter if you try to differentiate too much in terms of which platform is more active for a specific like addressable market. The numbers are so small from the sales perspective relative to the addressable market size and then relative to the amount of users on the platform. It doesn't really matter. What really matters is how effective you are in terms of your creative and messaging, right? And then how good that is in getting potential customers to purchase that product, right?
On that note, do you have an in-house creative team? How do you approach creative for your campaigns?
Yeah, so we do. We have graphic designers and video editors as well as a creative director. Yeah, that's actually been a massive focus for us over the last year. It's pretty interesting, but the strategy and tactics around setting up campaigns and managing campaigns and optimizing them is increasingly becoming obsolete because of just how these platforms are really heavily machine learning driven. So it's really important to work on the creative side of things. And so how do we do that? First of all, it just comes from conversations with our clients, right? And we really try to figure out from their understanding who their customers are, the language they use to describe their products, what are important kind of key features or benefits to highlight about the product, and then what specific products have sold and why they think they've sold. It's a lot of just different questions. We'll sit down as part of the onboarding and really try to figure out who their customers are and why is it, what are the important kind of key criteria that we should be describing and talking about these products or services or selling. Mm-hmm. Then we go into like testimonials and reviews. So we'll go into like Amazon and look through all their Amazon reviews, right? We'll go and look at all their competitors and we use a platform called TriAtria, which is a really cool way of, you can basically put in all the competitors and see all ads they ran on social platforms, right? So we'll get inspiration from how their competitors are advertising similar products. And then we'll take tried and true tactics that we know that work well in terms of advertising something lower funnel. So one important thing that always works is you lead with a question, right? So it's, have you ever had X problem, right? And then you follow up with benefit statements, and then you have like really strong call to actions. Another piece of that too is just having some sense of urgency to sell the product, right? You can say it's limited time inventory, or it's like limited inventory or limited time only sale, or you can have some other type of offer where it's buy two, get one free, things like that. So we'll take all this research and then we'll try to break it out into very specific components that we want to test. And so we'll test all those themes. And then within that, we'll go and we'll break out our ads by these modules that we want to test within the ads as well. So specifically for videos, we'll have a hook. We have a benefit statement, or sorry, hook. We have an agitation section. We have a benefit statement. Then we have a call to action, right? And so we'll take all those themes and we'll generate a ton of different hooks for each theme, a ton of different agitation points. And then we'll go package that up into all these kind of modular videos and we'll go test a bunch of them at one time. We'll run it for a couple of weeks. Really, generally, it's about a week or two. And then we'll identify which combination of things are working best. And then we pull those out and start iterating on them and then throw them back in and then scale spin behind them, right?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I love how rigorous of an approach you have to what creative to put out and how to approach the different messages. That's great.
Yeah, I think the way I describe it, it's like it's an empirical approach, right? Like we, as an agency, we're not the brand, we're not the consumer. We have to, you know, really understand what the brand wants to say about their product and what's okay to say. And then we have to understand what really resonates with the consumer. So I think it's best to go with the understanding that you don't know and then build a really good framework to identify what actually works. And then you constantly refine it from there. I think what a mistake that most agencies do and most people make generally is they make these kind of grand assumptions. And then it's a lot of throwing stuff against a wall and seeing what sticks. And that's just such an inaccurate way of doing it. This is a very methodical kind of mapped out approach where it's here's like the grid lines. And then here's where we think the treasure is. And then we'll get closer and closer as we find more clues. And then we hit jackpot. And then you scale our campaign on top of that.
There's a interesting study that Nielsen ran that found that for digital marketing, creative had the biggest effect on advertising effectiveness. I think this came out in 2017. And we also found just in my work in lower funnel direct marketing that targeting actually has the biggest effect in lower funnel effectiveness. Mm-hmm. That's definitely in line with what I've understood to be the case.
I would say to tie those two together today on social platforms like Meta, creative does your targeting. And so what I mean by that is if you have very clear messaging in your creative that speaks directly to your consumer, it will learn that and then know to deliver ads to your target audience. Especially today, like most campaigns people run are like in what are called Advantage Plus broad targeting campaigns. And those ones, we don't do any targeting. We just do the United States and 18 plus in terms of age, but we're very specific in the creative messaging, right? And so Meta will learn based on engagement with those ads, like who are most likely to be customers. And then they know to deliver ads to the right people and do the right targeting. There was a time when I ran campaigns, let's say 6 years ago, where we had incredibly sophisticated targeting, right? We would have hundreds of audience cuts based on different demographic elements, different like income profiles, different like historical purchase behavior. And we could get really sophisticated around that and how to really maximize sales through that. But that level of sophistication now is actually detrimental in your campaigns. Like ideally, you really focus on the creative side to allow Meta to learn who best to deliver those ads to and how best to do that targeting.
That's really interesting. Yeah, so for digital, you want to rely on those walled gardens to fine-tune their own algorithms for targeting.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is that good? Is it good that we give them that power? Or do you think that's a little bit imbalanced?
Oh, it's 100% imbalanced in favor of these platforms. And is it good? So the interesting thing is, what's the alternative? And so what I mean by that is we don't know actually how efficient your campaigns could be. Because it's that black box now, right? And these platforms also set CPMs. They're setting up these auctions. They're delivering the ads. They're determining who to deliver these ads. And so you don't know truly if that's as efficient as it could be, right? And so I'd say it's 100% balanced for these platforms, but it's effectively the price you have to pay now and to be an advertiser. What else are you going to do? Are you going to set up your own social platform and get all those users? And then it's tough. It's just what we have to do today.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way I see it, the privacy regulation makes it even harder to break in to the industry. So it's effectively a moat around the existing social vendors.
Yeah, 100%.
In the future, do you see this trend continuing? Do you see us for any reason going away from all of the privacy regulation?
No, I see. It's funny. I'm sure you watched the hearings with Mark Zuckerberg and Sundar and even the TikTok CEO, but I think the TikTok one was probably the best in terms of the representatives were a little bit more educated. But if you watch the one with Zuckerberg, they were so uneducated in terms of what Facebook does and how they track and things like that. So it's interesting. I think there's going to be increased regulation around privacy. I think it's going to be extremely hard to write good regulation around it because of the lack of knowledge of what these platforms do. And then add on to that, how these AI algorithms work, how these machine learning algorithms work. Like, people don't, there no lawmaker is going to understand that. And then two, just fundamentally, it's just like the accelerated rate of which these platforms change. So how do you write laws around that? Just knowing too, like, generally how slow our like legislative sessions are and like how slow it is to write laws, like, how are they ever going to catch up and meet the speed at which these platforms change and they develop, right? Yeah. But I'm sure there's going to be these broad strokes where they have regulation, but it's going to increase. I think people are increasingly more concerned. I think it's now the big focus is on AI, more so than what's being tracked about you, right? It's just the impact of AI, what decision making it has, how quote unquote smart does it get, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's the last question I'll ask is, when it comes to AI and all of the data that we produced to train those AIs, do you think there'll be a reckoning ever where eventually there comes a point where they're like, you did steal all of this data, period. Nobody got paid. Is there going to be a point where that has to be fixed?
I would say, my opinion, yes. But also too, how do you measure that? Like, it's almost impossible, right? There's a good book. I don't think it was really that accurate, but it was called Surveillance Capitalism by this woman, Shoshana Zuboff. It's really interesting. She wrote it, I think, in 20 is when she published it. But she talks about this a lot, where these platforms have collected a massive amount of data on us and profited off of it. But more importantly, they're effectively doing what could be considered like futures trading. And so what I mean by that is the value of this data collection isn't necessarily the data itself, but it's the predictive behaviors that they can then understand and then monetize that, right? Wow. And so it's not necessarily like your data being like, hey, you know, Hal, I live in Austin, Texas. It's no, because I live in Austin, Texas, I'm very likely to buy a dog or to adopt a dog because there's a much, you index much high, Austin indexes really highly for dog ownership. And so therefore they know, because I'm most likely to adopt a dog, I'm going to buy a dog bed, I'm going to start buying dog food, I'm going to whatever. And so that is a true value, right? And so then it's, how do you measure that? Because you're measuring like predictive behaviors, which isn't 100% certain, but then that's much more valuable because they're effectively going to monetize the rest of my life based on decisions they know I'm most likely to make into the future. So how do you measure that? So that's a really tough thing. And I think the more sophistication AI has, is the more it'll have clarity in terms of people's like decisions over their life and specifically purchase decisions, right? How do you measure that? That's an insane amount of value. Obviously, you're not going to get paid for that.
Yeah, it's very Minority Report vibes. Yeah. Yeah, that's so interesting. Oh, I love how you put that, because that is really the value. It's not just the information. It's what the information tells you, and it tells you where to point your media and your advertising so that it provides a lift to the people that are going to purchase, the people that are in the consideration set.
Yeah.
I love that. This has been such a great conversation, Hal. I want to thank you so much for joining and for sharing.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this. As you can tell, I nerd out about this stuff. Spend a lot of time thinking about it.
Yeah, that's amazing. All right. Thank you, Hal. It's great to chat again. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you soon.